welcome to another episode of What the Hell Happened? I'm your host, Kevin Kittleson, and this is episode 4. Last week, we talked about the Republican presidential debate where I told Scott Walker to sit down and shut up. I aired the podcast late Sunday evening, and by Monday afternoon, Scott Walker had chosen to sit down and shut up. He apparently would rather screw up the state of Wisconsin than screw up the rest of the country. I called that one, and I'm glad that he withdrew. Today, we will be talking to Professor Danny Lee Ingram, writer and Pulitzer Prize nominee for his book, Pennies on the Tracks. It should be a good interview, and I hope you really like it. On the home front, we had a tragedy. My father-in-law passed away, and he was a good guy. We had a lot of things in common. We both liked to hunt. We both liked to fish, and that was a bonding thing between us, even though we never did get to actually go hunting and fishing together because his health had deteriorated so much and so quickly. In other news on the home front, one of our kitties is in heat. The other two, we have our males and they're fixed. But it doesn't stop our little kitty from going off into yowling fits where she just won't shut up for a couple hours. And we are really looking forward to getting her spayed when the time is right and when the funds allow. So, without any further ado, I'd like to bring you Mr. Danny Ingram, professor of creative writing, and we'll find out what the hell happened with Danny. Welcome, fans, and today our very first guest on What the Hell Happened is Professor Danny Ingram, who is a professor in creative writing. And so how's the menagerie, the cats and the dogs you got there out on the Ingram Ranch?
they're good. The cats are here listening to me now. The dogs are outside snooping around, as usual. It's the time of day when the deer come strolling by.
Yeah, I would imagine that's got to be like their TV.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we got a few questions here for you today. Going to roll right into the interview part. What is your earliest memory?
My earliest memory?
Yeah.
Well, let me see. I think it was the doctor deciding which end to slap.
Yeah, that's a pretty early memory, unless it was like when you were like 3 or 4.
Unforgettable. Now, my earliest memory probably goes back to, I can't really remember that much, except playing in possibly a Maytag laundry box. I mean, like what the washing machine comes in.
Mm-hmm.
I remember playing in one of those.
Yeah, I think kids love boxes as much as they love the toys that are in, you know, they come in.
Just like a cat.
Pretty much, yep.
It's a toy and it'll play with a box.
As I remember, one Christmas we got a new washing machine and I think we spent more time in the box than we did actually playing with the Christmas gifts.
Yep, more fun.
So how did you get your start in creative writing?
Let's see. My first thing was back when I was in high school, and I think I was 14. Our high school was unusual. It went from the 8th grade through 12.
Ah.
Right, from the 8th grade through 12, and the elementary part went from 1 through 7. And I was about 14, and I had this dream. And it was about being in the jungles, you know, and sort of like the Sandinistas or whatever. And I was running guns, of all things, at age 14. And I woke up the next day, and I just thought I'd write the story. And I sent it off, for the heck of it, to a thing called Creative Writing, I think was the magazine. And it got published.
Well, that's pretty great for your first try. Most writers get the precursory list of rejection letters first.
Oh, that came later.
Yeah.
Paper a house with rejection letters.
Yeah, you could probably build one with rejection letters. I know I could have.
Right, right.
So, yeah, that's kind of like a Walter Mitty-esque beginning then.
Oh, yes. It started at the top, and it's all downhill from there.
Yeah, there you go. Would you rather be right about everything or truly happy?
Oh, happy, of course. I am not right several times a day.
Well, that I think that makes two of us anyway, and I think I'm about as happy as I can be under the circumstances. It could be a lot worse, I'll tell you that.
Oh yeah, yeah. But I added to the saying, you know, a lot of people say, well, it could be better.
Yeah, I've said that myself.
Yeah, and then I add, well, yes, and it could be worse.
There is that as well. Yeah, the could be better is very much a Minnesota response about, like, you know, how you doing? Well, could be better, or can't complain.
Sure you can.
I can, and you can. But I'm not in Minnesota anymore, to paraphrase Dorothy.
Yeah. Wait.
If you had a time machine, what would be your first destination?
I think I would like to go back in the sort of the Western Days era, around 1830, because it was a simple life, and it's sort of what I guess I'm reverting to now. You know, living out by the national forest and not in the heyday of the big cities, because I spent most of my life in the big cities, you know, with traveling and all that. So now it's just sort of kick back and watch the deer, you know.
Right. So a little bit of the Old West mentality of, like, you know, if you had a beef with somebody, you settled it out on the street rather than in a courtroom.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's one way to put it.
Yeah, I can see the draw to that. Now, tell us a little bit about Pennies on the Tracks, your first book. What inspired that compilation?
Oh, goodness. Well, that started out as sort of a gathering of stories that, part of it anyway, a gathering of stories that I had written for actual college class, you know, project. And then I would refine them, and I would keep them, and then I would go back and I would refine them again and rewrite and edit. And oh goodness, some of the stories I have edited at least 50 times over the years before I put them all into a book.
So do you find the editing process actually is more labor intensive than the writing process?
No, I wouldn't say labor intensive. I actually enjoy it, because I'll read through something and then I'll catch something that, you know, I might want to say in a little different way, and sometimes, you know, catch a mistake. Or, you know, the English language is very strange sometimes. You can have certain punctuation And then you can actually change that punctuation to change the meaning.
Right.
Just a little bit, yeah.
Right, yeah. It's all about kind of honing down the craft or honing down the message that you're trying to get down or, you know, out there.
Right. In Teenies on the Tracks, for instance, there was a story. It's called Gravity. And in one place I had written that one of the characters' father had passed away from brown lung. Okay, now you consider the word brown and the condition of brown lung. Well, it is really a condition. But what I was going for was black lung.
Right.
Another condition from coal mining.
Right, I'm familiar with that.
Yes, but brown lung, which my father spent, you know, a lot of his life in the cotton mill. And brown lung comes from spending a lot of time in the cotton mill. So I guess it was ingrained in my brain that this character died from brown lung instead of black lung. But, you know, later on, I mean, this took some years till I, you know, a friend of mine brought it to my attention, actually. And I went back and said, oh, yeah, I better change that. So I had to go back and change one word. And that's a big thing when you change one word in a book.
Yeah, it can be, yeah.
Yes. So I did it. If I find something, I will go back and I will try to figure out what have I done. But I tell you what's curious. Anyway, let me stick to the topic. You said, how did I get inspired for Teenies on the Tracks? Well, for one thing, in the small town where I grew up, which is, we lived on one side of the railroad tracks and the cotton mill was on the other side of the railroad tracks. We lived in an area called Frogtown, which the houses were actually built up about, oh gosh, I guess 4 or 5 feet off the ground on, you know, bricked up all around, because every spring, the river, which was nearby, would leave its banks. And I remember as a child, this wasn't my earliest memory, but as a child, I used to stand on the front porch and I had a plastic PT-109 boat. I think that was what Kennedy drove during the war. But anyway, I put it on my fishing line and I would let the boat go float down the street on the up, you know, when the river got up.
Sure.
It would reel it in, and it would look like it was powered. Yeah. Some children are easily amused.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I made paper airplanes, and, you know, those are, you know, kind of a limited attention span for a while.
Right. Yeah. And so from that, you know, from the cotton mill being there, the river getting up, and things like that, I was inspired by that small town life, and then when I went on out and lived in the world a while, so to speak, I got inspired by the rural places.
Not
by the downtown big city places, but by the rural, and look where I am.
Exactly, right, out in the boondocks, as it were.
I have my own little Walden's Pond back here, except it's a creek.
There you go. Hey, if it works for you, that's the important thing.
Right.
So, where would readers, I mean, the listeners of this podcast may want to get a copy of Pennies on the Tracks. Where would they find one?
Well, the easiest way to get it is on Lulu.com. Just plug in my name, Danny Lee Ingram, into the Lulu search window.
And that's LULU, right?
Right. LULU.com.
Well, that could be a good read for them. I'm sure that they'd enjoy going through some of the poetry and the short stories that you have compiled there?
Well, actually, there are no poems in the actual Phoenix on the Tracks book. It's 13 short stories, and I intentionally wrote it where you can either read it for entertainment alone, or you can stick it in a graduate school class and tear it apart, and I'm ready to defend it.
Oh, yes, as always. So, do you frequently put pennies on the track?
I did when I was a kid.
I had to ask that.
Is that there was a myth. It's not just an urban myth. There's a myth everywhere that if you put a penny on the track, it might cause the train to derail. So every time I put one on there, I was afraid there might be a train wreck, or it might, you know, just do me well and flatten the penny out, and then I'd have a little, you know, token here. Look at this.
Yeah, I did the same thing, and I don't think I ever derailed a train, so we're both in luck in that department.
Right. I started to play with the punctuation on a short story and stick it in there a long time ago and call it Pennies on the Track, like it was some person I used to date, some lady I used to date named Penny.
That'd be a different twist. I'm sure that would derail the train.
Yeah, Penny's on the Tracks. Yeah, a little different.
Oh, you could just do a little, you know, different punctuation there. Just put the apostrophe after the or before the S.
Right, you could spell it that way. Sure. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. You've done a lot of entertaining over years that differs from your writing. What's the most valuable advice you've ever given a budding writer?
A budding writer. Okay. I would say don't give up. Grow a thick skin, because that water is going to roll right off your back. You know, if one version doesn't get published, go back, look at it. If there's anything you want to change, change it. If there's not, doesn't matter. Send it off again. Send it to someone else. Because I believe it was Ironweed. Kennedy in Ironweed, who wrote Ironweed. He sent, if I'm not mistaken, he sent Ironweed off about 20 times. And it got turned down, and then all of a sudden, he won the Pulitzer with it.
Wow. He didn't give up.
Yeah, that's from getting slapped with a wet fish to going to having caviar, you know, overnight.
Now, I don't think I've asked you this question before, but, you know, if I have, correct me. You've done a lot of entertaining... that differs from your writing. Did acting and performing music in any way influence your writing style?
Oh, definitely. Acting gives you a physical feel of how a character would behave. You know, we had to, as actors in college, we had to write a character profile, even if there was none in the script whatsoever. We had to go home, write a character profile. You know, where did this person grow up?
A backstory.
Right. Backstory. And it never appears in the play or whatever. It appears in the act. And that's what I try to do with the characters, you know, like, just to put it bluntly, where is this person coming from?
Yeah, like, you know, a little bit of their, you know, what motivates them that isn't readily apparent on stage. It's not something the screen or the playwright wrote. It's something that was specific to the acting.
Right. Well, some people wonder why. Oh, I might drive up and I'll get, at the gas station, I might get gasoline in multiples of $4. I may get $4, $8, $12, $16, or when gas is up, you know, $100.
Right.
I hope not, but still a multiple of four. Now, with my own personal backstory, where does that come from? I'm glad you asked, even though you didn't. I used to read a lot of Tony Hillerman.
Ah.
That's a lot about the Four Corners Indians, Native Americans. Well, there's another backstory. I lived in Montana, where the people I knew there who were tribal, they did not like the term Native American. They told me to call them an Indian, which is strange. You know, they said, hey, that's Hollywood stuff. I'm an Indian. I said, okay. And that was Navajo mainly up there that I knew. But anyway, Tony Hillerman wrote about the Four Corners people in a detective series, sort of. There was a sheriff's department. And I sort of became to know a lot about the Native Americans or Indians and their beliefs and their ways of life through Tony Hillerman. And I got into this multiples of four because of the four seasons, the four winds, you know, and all this. Whereas a lot of writers and people dwell on the Trinity.
Right, the triples, things coming. That's kind of a comedy thing.
Right, right. But you know, and the seven, the number seven, and the number 40. You know, which of course is a multiple of four, but those numbers appear in the Bible a lot. 3, 7, and 40.
Hmm.
You know, 4 days, 40 nights. You know, and seven, I can't think of one right now, but I know it's in there. But of course, you got the four horsemen.
I think in Oriental or, you know, Far Eastern beliefs, you also have the four elements, too. You have fire, wind, earth, and rain, or water.
And let's think of music. A lot of rock is in 4/4.
Right.
Not 3/3.
No, you don't see a lot of that unless you're listening to Frank Zappa.
Or Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, there you go. There's a couple of them that, you know, come from a jazz background that might, you know, mix it up a little bit.
Right, right, right. Of course, 3/4, you know, the waltz thing, but waltz is not really my heartbeat music. My heartbeat music is 4/4.
Yeah, I think mine's the same. Well, that was definitely a very revealing question. So you have a degree in creative writing and teach classes. I think I just asked this basically, but what advice? I think we've already asked that one. Which was the best advice you could give to a budding writer? And you said that it was to develop a thick skin.
Oh yeah.
So yeah. In that light, what do you think is the biggest pitfall you see budding writers have?
They give up. That's the biggest pitfall. They stop writing. Continue writing is what I say. No matter what somebody else says. A lot of people, you know, they make the mistake, and I'm sorry to say this, but they will depend on what their friends and neighbors say about their writing. Now, you know, what are they going to say? Of course they like it. Sounds great, you know, all this stuff. And it makes you feel good, you know. You have a little pat on the back. And then you look in the mailbox and there, or the email, and there's the notorious rejection.
Right.
What did I do wrong? Well, you have to take a very fine look. You have to look at, okay, what is the background of these people who, you know, live near me? My friends, do they have a background in writing and all this? Do they have a background in editing? Now, granted, some editors are on the moon somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
Just like I said, you know, Kennedy got rejected all those times, and all of a sudden, somebody saw something in his writing, and it was, you know, given a Pulitzer Prize.
I mean, you know, when you think about it, it's kind of like the Beatles. They went to all kinds of different record labels and kept getting turned down, turned down, turned down. And finally, I think it was Decca, said, okay, we'll take a chance on these guys, even though we really don't think they got that much going on. And they just exploded.
Right. They took a chance and, well, what can you say? Roll the dice sometimes. And that's why, you know, don't give up, because you might be giving up one publisher short of getting your work published.
Sure, that publisher might have had a bad day, or somebody was, you know, on his case about something, or he may have had a different deadline that he needed to get a romance story in rather than something what you've submitted. And so you just kind of got, it's like a shotgun approach is the way I look at it, is that you kind of keep shooting it, eventually you're going to hit something.
Well, you know, there's the story of Harry Potter, and that first book, I'm not sure exactly how true the whole thing is, but what I've heard is that it ended up on the bottom of the stack, scheduled for file 13. You know what file 13 is? The good old wastebasket. But the editor saw it sticking out of the bottom and just happened to reach down there and take it out. And it was handwritten, from what I gather. The first Harry Potter.
Right, and it really changed the life of J.K. Rowling.
Oh, tell me about it. Tell me about it. She was, you know, from what I gather, she was living in public housing and all this, and trying to get by the best she could, and voila.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, if you had a choice, would you rather be rich or famous?
That's sort of a leading question.
Somebody's asked me that one before too. You know, would you rather be rich or famous? And I said, well, you can spend riches, but you can't spend fame.
Right. Yeah. If I had the choice, I guess I would rather go for the fame, just because, not for being famous and rich, but for being famous for writing or music.
Famous on your merits.
Right.
Right, I understand that. So,
now, respect. And that's, you know, I like, you know, if 13 people are, you know, 13. There's the 13 short stories popping up.
Yep, there you go.
If the 13 people respect me for my writing, great. You know, I don't care if I've got two pennies to rub together. If somebody respects my writing, and who, you know, especially those who are qualified to and can sit down and talk to me about it, you know, in terms of a literary term.
Sure.
I don't cut down anybody who can't do that. That's why I wrote my things on the tracks, so that it can be read for entertainment. Even my aunts have read it, and they like it. Of course, your family's going to say they like it, right?
Generally.
But they can't tell me why.
I don't know. I just did. That's just usually the response they give.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you sit down with someone who is, you know, sort of versed in the background of writing or English, and they can discuss with you, you know, I see where you went with this character, and then ask you questions about why would this character do such a thing, and then you can say, well, in my backstory for this character, or, you know, this is how this happened to this character when he was younger. You know, you can always defend.
Sure, yeah.
Ammunition that you know your character, then you will be able to defend your character.
Right. So now that, let's say you're rich or famous, what would you have for your favorite meal?
My favorite meal is grilled lobster.
Oh, that sounds pretty doggone good. Yeah. I'd probably double up and go steak and lobster, have the surf and turf.
If I didn't eat red meat for all those years.
Ah, that's true.
Yeah, for many, many years, I did not eat red meat. And then I ended up with a health situation, and it had nothing to do with red meat. The doctors actually told me, one said, just think of all the hamburgers you missed. And I said, oh, well, it turned out to be a hereditary problem, but you know, it's not, I get by with it. Everybody has something. As Rosanna Dana used to say, it's always something, right?
Right. I mean, you have some people that can't have gluten, too, so it's sort of like, you know, well, your life just goes on, but it's just minus a thing or two.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, I guess I'm a glutton for gluten.
So, if Hollywood was to do a movie about your life, which actor would you like to play you?
Good question. Well, I'm lost for words. I'm not sure which part of my life, because you see, I had different parts of my life. I grew up. I'm not gonna beat around the bush. When I grew up, I was kind of a little backward. You know, we lived in a frog town, and you know, it was a cotton mill family. Lived in a cotton mill constructed house, you know, in Cotton Mill Village. And I remember I was a teenager before I even walked into a restaurant like a Burger King. And I really didn't know how to order. I'd been to, you know, the drive-in, like the A&W and the Dairy Queen and stuff like that, but I was up a teenager before I went into, you know, a regular fast food restaurant. And I had to watch the other people to actually know what to do.
So I guess when they finally decide to make a movie about your life, you'll have to sift and winnow through the potential actors that would play you at various ages.
Right, right. Well, in the early days, you know, I had much more of a southern accent, of course. So it would be the younger me would have a southern accent. And then I got on up to, you know, I started on the road playing music after my little stint of being an apprentice electrician, but that's another story. But I went into playing music on the road after a brief marriage that didn't work. But I won't get into that.
I understand. I had a brief engagement, so I just didn't get to the marriage point, but it was one of those things that would have probably ended as well. You know, one of those things about when you're young and you think you have all the answers, and then after a few years you realize, maybe I don't.
Well, the thing about it is, it was sort of strange. We had a, you know, the perfect little wedding, and I actually had more hair back then. And we had a very nice wedding, and they used our wedding pictures as, you know, as promo in the newspaper for the, you know, for the wedding company or whatever. And then when I got the opportunity, a friend of mine, Rodney Nelson, called me up, and his father was a Jewel Tea coffee man. I don't know if you know what that is.
Oh, yes, I remember Jewel Tea. It was kind of like Avon Lady with products.
Right, and they had these little trucks. I think they turned them into postal trucks now.
Yeah, probably.
Kind of truck, little truck, and they would come around, you know, sort of like home delivery.
Yep, here's your Jewel Tea brownie mix.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, anyway, he had one of those. He had gotten from his father. His father was a Jewel Tea coffee man. And he offered me, you know, let's go to Colorado and play some music. I said, okay. So, you know, I thought it was a chance, you know, to get out there, and I was always playing around town, you know, a little something in a gas station, about anywhere we could we could play.
Right, I know the feeling. I was in kind of a similar situation to that.
Right. And so I got in the old truck, and it was nothing but sheet metal on the side. And gosh, when we got to, I think it was Nebraska. Either Oklahoma or Nebraska, headed out to Colorado. I forgot which way we actually went that time. But the wind was so strong that the walls were sort of going in and out. And talk about noisy. Oh, my goodness. It felt like being inside an airplane crashing, I guess.
Yeah, I can imagine, although that metal kind of buckling against the frame of the truck.
Yeah, it wasn't really doing damage. It was just the noise it was making going back and forth, you know. Like taking a piece of sheet metal and shaking it in the, you know, in the air.
So you get to Colorado, and that had to have been kind of a, I'm not in Kansas anymore, or in your case, I'm not in Georgia anymore.
Yes. It was just wonderful. I mean, I bit the line, you know, hook, line, and sinker, as they say, and I loved it. Had a great experience there. We had a 6-week run, the first time I'd ever played on the road, and it was in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, a ski town that I guess a lot of people know about, sort of like another Vail or whatever.
Right.
But we got there in the summer, and it was just beautiful.
So the bug kind of bit you right there.
Oh, yes.
So if you woke up tomorrow and found out you had a superpower, what would it be?
Ooh, a superpower. I would probably want to fly.
That's a pretty common one. I actually chose the power to have access of overall time and dimension so that I could travel where I wanted to go within the blink of an eye.
Wow. That's nice.
Yeah, I still haven't woke up with it yet, so, you know, what are you going to do?
Well, I'm a big Stargate fan, so I guess I think of, you know, walking through the Stargate, but then I could still fly.
Right. Yeah, why not? If you're going to have a power, I mean, I think flight's a pretty common one.
Yeah.
So if you won the lottery, what would you do with it?
Well, first thing I would do would probably... Oh, goodness. I think there are a few people that I would like to give money to who have been good to me over the years when I was, you know, down at the bottom of the wagon wheel rut, and, you know, they would not take anything back, you know what I mean?
Yeah, pay it forward, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah, that sounds like something that I would do as well.
Yeah.
If one of your books caused you to be a household name, how would you deal with the attention?
Well, it depends on what that part of the household. Would it be the toilet, or would it be...
I guess if it got your name out there and everybody's like, you know, Danny Ingram wrote this, Danny Ingram, you know, and then, I was just kind of thinking, I wonder if they would come out to try to find out where you are in the boondocks and kind of interfere with your solitude. How would you deal with that?
I always like to have good opening lines or whatever like that. So if someone's in the kitchen and they said, hey, get me the Ingram opener.
Yeah, which is way more preferable than the bathroom. You've also written a lot of poetry. Do you prefer poetry over fiction? And if so, why?
No, I don't prefer one over the other. I love poetry. I still write a lot of poetry, as a matter of fact. More poetry lately than fiction. But my forte in fiction has been so far short stories. It's like getting to the point, and a lot of people have accused me, not accused, but say I write like so-and-so or so-and-so. Well, I'm actually just being myself. But it's interesting, like they would say something like, that's like an O'Connor story or whatever.
Sure.
In the fiction, the short stories, a lot of times I don't really resolve. I leave that to the reader to resolve what happened.
Mm-hmm.
That way the reader, every reader might get just a little different view on what happens. For instance, in the first story in Pennies on the Tracks, it's called Reunion. And a lot of people will ask me, and have asked me, well, at the end of the story, did the guy die? And I say, you tell me.
Right, yeah, kind of like in some ways with music and an album, you kind of leave it open as universal, so it could mean different things to different people. It doesn't necessarily have to mean one specific thing.
Right, there was, in my last, I guess you could say, well, really three-piece band here locally, the guitar player, he loved to have things resolved at the end of a song. Well, when I was on the road, a lot of times we would, like, the end of a song, we would cut a song off at a peak point, you know?
Sure.
It's like, you get to the top, and you're just about to go down the other side of the roller coaster, and you don't.
Yeah, I actually did that with one of my songs. It was only like about 2 minutes and 30 seconds long, and I had a couple people complain that they wanted it to be longer, but I said, that's kind of the point. It's like, if you write a song, you want the song, you want people to be thinking, gosh, I want to hear that again, because I wish it could be longer. I want to hear it again. The Beatles did that a lot, I believe.
And also, we did it on the road a lot of times to give it a sort of a segue into the next song, especially if the next song is in the same root key.
Sure, right, exactly, because you could kind of like almost do like a medley type situation.
Right, right.
Now, you've suffered from MS for years. What do you think needs to be done to bring attention to this disease?
Well, I wish people would understand more about it, actually. It's I'll get a little technical here. It's a breakdown in the coating of the nerves and things in the brain. If you think of the inside of the brain as like wires, like electric wires with insulation around them, well, that's called myelinization. And MS is actually demyelinization, and it's a destruction of the coating, which in turn causes the nerves, if you want to put it bluntly. I don't know exactly what the nerves call, you know, some people might call them neurons, but I'm not a doctor. I only play one on TV.
Right.
But anyway, it's a breakdown in that coating, and it can cause things to short out, not function properly, everything. I remember the worst thing that happened to me was I almost lost all of my sight when it first hit me. And my brain had to actually relearn itself, thank goodness it did, how I could see.
Hmm.
And it affects a lot of people. I am so lucky. I have had MS now for, I'm trying to count, but it's been, several decades.
Right. It's been a long time.
Right. And, I'm lucky I can still walk. I have my bad days when I will stumble, I will fall. But you know what? It's just like the rejection letter. If you fall, get up again when you can.
And, I mean, the other good thing, too, is that, you know, you started out as a drummer and shifted to bass playing, so you didn't let it stop you from playing music.
No, No, it's I was afraid that it would stop me from being very reliable, you know, full time on drums, because I had a few incidents, you know, where my arms and my hands would just go haywire. And even when I switched over to bass, I was playing one night, and what I did was I played with my thumb a lot, you know.
Sure.
And all of a sudden, my thumb would not work. And this was in the middle of a night. And I instantly had to switch over to my fingers. And that's why I play with my fingers now. I mean, my thumb works again.
Sure.
Fingers seem to be right there.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you should say that, because I know that John Entwistle of The Who definitely played with his fingers mostly. He was not your typical bass player. He learned on stand-up bass, but he primarily played with his fingers, which kind of gives people a unique sound.
Yes, it's definitely a different sound, but also I will use my thumb for slapping.
There you go. Yeah, the slap bass.
A little funk bass here and there, I'll pull that out of my hat, and I'll use my thumb and finger for plucking.
Yep, you can do that too.
I'll pluck especially on things like Mustang Sally. I have this one note that I love to pluck, and that's pluck, P-L-U-C.
I was just going to say, and if they don't like it, pluck you.
Right. Just don't fret about it, play it.
Yeah, exactly. Danny, by the way, is the master of puns to the listeners. We used to have some massive pun battles. In fact, kind of leads into my next question, is what is your funniest memory?
Oh, goodness. Music-wise?
Anything-wise. I mean, it doesn't have to be connected with any particular thing.
Well, I have several funny nights with music playing. One was with you and me. We went to see a band, and I suddenly began seeing everything, and I called it 3D. Well, of course it's in 3D.
Yeah, that one. That was a funny memory. Yeah, it still lives on after all these years.
Yeah, you have to, you gotta watch how many of those Wisconsin brews or whatever.
Yeah, you know, in some ways, it would be nice to get back into 3D mode again one of these days.
Right.
Now,
I'll take another quick one if you want to hear it.
We're kind of running a little short now. I mean, as far as the interview goes, we're getting kind of winding down to the tail end of it. But there is the other thing is a question I wanted to ask is, who is the most famous person that you've ever met, and how did that happen?
Well, it was, I'm going to stick to writers, and it was probably John Updike.
Ah, okay, John Updike.
Yeah, when I was in grad school, he came and did a couple of lectures, you know, in creative writing. And, of course, I love his writing. I'll never forget that opening line, "In walks these three girls."
And I know you met Johnny Paycheck as well.
Oh, yeah. In music, Johnny Paycheck was, and I also, I got to say hello to Cher, and she said hello back, and that was about the extent of that.
Well, you're one up on most people. She doesn't really have the best reputation of being warm and friendly.
Well, this was back in the days when she was with Greg.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, she wasn't the big, the big time, real big time herself, except for, being with Sonny at that time.
Now, let's say you're teaching a class. What would piss you off during class?
Someone on the computer online.
Okay, so somebody basically not paying attention, just surfing the web.
Well, it's that they're paying. It would be someone who is not doing that well in the class and doesn't get allegory and, you know, metaphor and all that, and yet they spend their time online. What are you doing here?
Right.
This is your money. What are you doing here? You can do that at home.
What book would you consider a masterpiece?
Oh, what book? Wow, there's so many.
Yeah, it's like asking somebody, what's your favorite album?
Right. Gosh. And then I would have to ask, well, what category, you know?
Sure. We'll say fiction.
Fiction. Well, I actually love some of the simpler books that have allegory underneath, sort of like the way I write.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, this is going to shock you, but I love Anne of Green Gables.
An old classic?
Yes.
Yeah, my mom actually liked that book so much that she told me I should read it.
Well, there are several, you know, books in the row of that.
Oh, yeah, she made that clear because she was a big fan.
Right. And, of course, when I was in, I think it was about the fifth grade, I had a teacher named Ms. Broom, and she would read to us about every day from Laura Ingalls' books. Little House on the Prairie.
Yeah, those were great books. I read, I think, pretty much every one in the series. And when my oldest daughter was in her late teens, I went to go pick her up from her grandparents' house, and we went to go to the actual location where Laura Ingalls Wilders was born.
Right.
And the cabin was rebuilt, of course, but it was still where she was born. Now, we've only got like a few minutes left here, so I want to ask you a couple more questions. One of them is, what's the worst job you ever had?
Oh, wow. The worst job. Does that include the boss?
The boss?
Yeah. Are you saying the actual job itself or the boss?
Just, yeah. Oh, I see. Yeah, just the job, actually. The boss, you know, because threw me second there. I mean, I didn't think he worked for Bruce Springsteen.
I would probably say the worst job I had was when I was working on what they call the jigs in the dye house in the cotton mill. What you did was you took pieces of cloth that were remnants, you know, that might have gotten dye splashed on them, whatever. But they didn't throw the cloth away. They would send it to you. And it was like a gigantic washing machine. But you would put it in there, put the cloth in there, and there would be, you know, different colored pieces and all that. And you would have to mix a dye that would cover up everything, you know, so that to make it a darker color so, you know, nobody would know.
Right, to hide the imperfections.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was really hard. It was really hard getting that right because you'd have to take what's called patches of the cloth, and you'd have to keep, you know, adding dye to it or subtracting dye to get it a certain shade. You know, there was supposedly by the coats and ties up front says, you know, well, it's got to match this. And, you know, with what they give you to work with that remnant cloth, oh my goodness.
Yeah, I've had a few of those jobs myself, but not in the cotton industry.
Right.
If you could have dinner with any writer, living or dead, who would it be, and what would you have for dinner?
Well, actually, living, I would love to have dinner with you again.
Wow, that's a high honor. That would be fun.
Yeah, because you are a good writer, and what would we have for dinner? Grilled lobster.
Of course.
Yes.
Because we know how to order from Burger King now.
Oh, yeah. I heard that back in the early days.
What do you think is the worst aspect of the recording industry today?
Oh, wow. Well, you probably noticed that I post songs on Facebook.
Right.
You know that. But I'll post anywhere from, you know, some funk to some new stuff to a lot of classic rock. And I still stick to the audio version. Pardon me, but the video version is like a movie over a book. You know, the video section takes something. Music is meant to be listened to, not watched necessarily. You know, you can see the act, the musicians perform in concert, but you're also listening to it.
Right.
You sing it live.
Which is actually one of the reasons that I enjoyed going to see Pink Floyd, because the attention really was not on the band on the stage so much as it was on the light show or the movies they were playing behind them, but the music was there, and so you paid attention to the music being played more than the musicians and what they were doing on stage.
I'm probably one of few people who go to a concert and close his eyes a lot.
And just listen.
Right. Listen to them doing it live, which is great. Because the video comes forth and it imposes something on something. Like, you know, if I read a book, for instance, and I see the word green. Well, if you read it, you might, in your mind, you might see Kelly Green.
Yeah.
You might see Aqua Green.
Sure, there was
time I'm reading it, whatever, you know.
Yeah, there was a friend of mine that actually said, you know, when you read the word green or blue, how do you know that my blue is the same as your blue?
Right.
Yeah. And one final question. Well, actually, I have two questions. One of them is something that I think is a question that's been around for a long time. Do you believe an artist has to suffer to create something inspirational?
No, I don't believe that's a necessary prerequisite, because there may be some people who are just very lucky in life.
That's true, yeah.
Just come along and they're just as creative as all get out, and you know, it's a lot of it comes back to my belief in genetic memory.
Sure.
Some people believe in reincarnation. Well, I have this strange vision and belief in genetic memory, where something is passed along through the genetics, and your body may pick up on it. You may not necessarily remember it or have these flashbacks to another life or whatever, but it's a part of you.
Interesting. Yeah, actually, my significant other, Jerry, and I have had talks about that, where we talk about like a collective memory of like ancestral memory.
Right.
So I think that's interesting that you come up with a similar thing there. And then my last question for you for the interview is, what the hell happened?
Well, what happened to me was I sort of lived by dream. Mostly I got to play on the road. I got to play with some big names now and then. I got to do what I wanted to do. That's the main thing in life. How many people actually, for instance, I intentionally studied writing at college and grad school, you know, English and writing.
Right.
Well, I got to do what I wanted to do. When I was on the road playing music, I got to do what I wanted to do. And how many people in life can actually say that about their job?
Not very many. A lot of people kind of get stuck into a cubicle someplace, and they earn a good living, so they stay there with it, and it kind of creates a trap for them where they do a job they don't like for most of the day. They come home, they eat some supper that they think is going to make them happy, watch a little TV, go to bed, get up, repeat, but they're never really happy with their lives.
But, you know, here's the way I look at it. No matter what you do as a job or whatever, if you find a little bit of time per day to do what you want to do, do it.
Right. All right, folks. That was a Professor Danny Lee Ingram. He's got a book called Pennies on the Tracks that you can get at lulu.com. That's lulu.com. And I believe he's got a book of poetry coming out in the near future. I don't know what the title of that is. You want to enlighten us with that, Danny?
Well, I don't know what the title of it is either, but there will be a lot of allegory. And I write a lot in the haiku and senryu mode.
Right.
If you don't like to read a lot, you can read this, but you read a lot into it.
So, you know, because it's shorter poetry, that might make you a bathroom name.
That could be.
All right, man. It's been great chatting with you, and I hope all the listeners really enjoyed listening to Danny as much as I enjoyed talking to him.
Thank you.
Yep. Take care, my friend, and I'm sure we'll be talking soon.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to another episode of What the Hell Happened with your host, Kevin Kittleson. I hope you enjoyed our interview with Danny Lee Ingram, the professor of creative writing. Check out his book, Pennies on the Tracks, on lulu.com. And tune in next week for some more fun, and we'll see what's going to happen. Stay tuned.